This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What about all that Iraqi oil? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Bush administration says oil had nothing to do with the invasion that led to regime change, but Iraq still has the second or third largest oil reserves in the world, and they're easily accessible. A recent report claims some of Iraq's new leaders are already making deals that could lead to massive profits for U.S. and British oil companies. On To the Point, will Iraqis get a fair deal? Will the oil companies tie up their most important resource for years to come? Or is Iraq just too dangerous and unstable to interest foreign investors? Also today, a major defeat for President Bush. Patriot Act renewal dies in the Senate. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. A new report says some of Iraq's new leaders are making deals that could lead to massive profits for U.S. and British oil companies. On To the Point, will the Iraqis get their fair share? Is Iraq just too dangerous to interest foreign investors? On Reporter's Notebook, new reports today of domestic spying secretly authorized by President Bush. First, this news update. President Bush lobbied hard for reauthorization of Patriot Act provisions scheduled to expire at the end of the year. But Republicans today failed to stop a threatened filibuster, and the bill died in the Senate. Bobby Block is Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Glad to be back.
What happened?
Well, they know a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum just really didn't like this, particularly in the Senate. The Senate, when the Senate and the House were looking at reauthorizing and renewing the Patriot Act, many of which 16 of its provisions were due to expire at the end of this year, they came up with very different versions. The Senate version was much more focused on judicial oversight and was widely thought to be more balanced. The House version was much more tilted in the direction of law enforcement, giving law enforcement what it wanted. There was a long debate to try to put these two bills together and come up with one. The Senate, the provisions in the Senate bill did not make it to the final. The House passed their version the other day, no problems. But the problems were not going to make it through the Senate, and you have both Republicans and Democrats who did not feel that what they were looking at was balanced.
Five Republicans voted against the reauthorization: Hagel of Nebraska, Murkowski of Alaska, Sununu of New Hampshire, Larry Craig of Idaho, and the majority leader, Mr. Frist. Why did he vote against it?
Well, that's a very good question because, up until early this morning, he was putting through a motion of cloture, which would have prevented the opponents of the bill from filibustering. He lost. The funny thing is that I think that part of the problem was the story that you mentioned earlier, which appears in the New York Times today, that talked about the president making an extraordinary signature authorizing the Department of Defense to spy domestically. So much of what you saw in the Patriot Act when was challenged, business, very interestingly, until very recently, big business was very opposed to what was going on in the Patriot Act. And every time they were talking to the Department of Justice, what they were concerned about were the incredible powers to basically look at privileged information, proprietary information, without needing really to show why they wanted to do it. It enabled them, if they so wanted, to go on fishing expeditions. And every time they raised this objection, the Department of Justice said, "We would never do that. Trust us." And then here you have on the front page of the New York Times that the president has authorized secret surveillance. I think people basically said, "The trust, you've abused the trust aspect of this, and we're not sure we want to go here."
Bobby Block, again, Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Apparently there's a strategic reason also for Senator Frist's vote. He's still in favor of reauthorization, but you have to vote with the majority in order to call for a new vote, and apparently there's some plan to do that, although it's my understanding that the possibility of a sort of interim approval, an extension of the act as it exists now, isn't going to fly with the White House or Congress. They want to blame the Democrats holding up this bill.
Right, they want to play hardball, but I think at the end of the day, if push comes to shove, the aim is they want to fix it. And if this thing looks like it's going to lapse, you can rest assured they're going to extend it. I think what's going to end up happening is I think Alan Spector, who is the Senate chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he was really in favor of the bill that passed the Senate, the version of the bill which passed the Senate unanimously a few months back. I think this strengthens his hand. Most people find it to be very balanced. Most people feel it gives law enforcement what it needs, but it also provides proper civil liberties. I think you're going to see him pushing very hard, and I think that this is where the tension's going to be. But if December 31st is rolling around and they don't have a bill, they are going to extend it. They're refusing to extend it right now as a tactical move to try to force the issue, try to get something that they want on the table. I think there are too many problems with this, and we're going to see some tennis back and forth over the next few weeks.
Pretty hard in the meantime for the president when that many Republicans, senior Republicans too, say we can't trust you.
Oh no, there is no doubt. This is one of his centerpieces of legislation. He has put a lot of political capital into getting this bill reauthorized, to getting the Patriot Act, the version that they wanted out there. You have to remember, the Department of Justice and the White House really wanted the version that came out of the House. It was much harder, much less inclined to judicial oversight. They failed on that one. They ended up with a compromise bill, but this bill could not get over the critics. This is definitely bad news for the White House, which finds itself now under fire precisely for violating the trust with this with the New York Times story revelations that came out today.
Lots of negotiations to come, lots of posturing as well on both sides, as you mentioned. Bobby Block, Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, good to have you with us.
We'll
have
a lot.
A little more later on our program about these reports of domestic spying. In the meantime, in a moment, we'll talk about all that Iraqi oil on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. Iraq has the second or third largest oil reserves in the world, but they were controlled by American, French, and British oil companies until they were nationalized in 1972. Long before September 11th, U.S. policymakers were saying that Saddam Hussein's use of oil as a diplomatic weapon made Iraq a destabilizing influence to the flow of oil to the industrialized world. Now, Iraq's new government may be creating a golden opportunity for the Western oil companies to get back into the action. Dr. James Paul is director of the Global Policy Forum, which has co-published a recent study called Crude Designs, the Ripoff of Iraq's Oil Wealth. Dr. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Very nice to be with you.
Tell us what is meant by Production Sharing Agreements, or PSAs.
Well, Production Sharing Agreements are a legal mechanism by which private oil companies enter into an agreement with sovereign states to produce oil in that territory of that state. And they offer a very interesting legal twist, which is the state retains formal legal control and sovereignty over the oil, but at the same time, the oil companies are able to book this oil into their own balance sheets, and they're able to have very, very substantial control over the process of the lifting of the oil. And also, these agreements are typically secret, and they last for a very long time.
When you say they can put it on their balance sheets, you mean then that they can claim that oil as an asset, even though they don't essentially own it?
That's correct.
And when you say they then have a lot of control over the extraction of oil, what form does that take? What do you mean?
Well, it has to do with the rhythm of extraction and of course, ultimately the exporting and marketing of that oil.
So by rhythm, you mean how much they take out and when they do it?
Yes, how much they take out is a very important issue because for years in Iraq, the companies actually didn't produce very much oil, and that was a source of great conflict between the companies and the government.
What's the importance of secrecy in this particular case? A lot of things about the oil business are secret.
Well, what it means is that if the new government of Iraq enters into an agreement with the oil companies, and that's a secret agreement, that means it's completely untransparent to the people of Iraq, and no one quite knows what's been agreed to and when and for how long.
Okay, you said that typically these production sharing agreements go on for a long time. How long? How many years?
Well, of course, it depends. It varies from one to another, but the typical agreement runs anywhere from 25 to 40 years, which is an awfully long time. And obviously, if they make those agreements now, that's going to last for practically the full length of these oil fields and into the far distant future.
What are we talking about with regard to Iraq's oil fields? How big are they? And by comparison to other potentially new sources of oil, how difficult or how easy are they to extract the oil from?
Well, that's one of the reasons the companies are so interested in Iraqi oil. It's relatively close to the surface. There are huge reservoirs, and some of them, the so-called supergiant or elephant fields, are so large that they, for instance, one field called Majnun at 21 billion barrels is as large as all of the reserves of Exxon put together in the year 2004. So if Exxon were to get a PSA for Majnun, as some people expect, that would mean they could at one sweep double their total reserves, and that's the biggest oil company and the biggest company in the world.
What about the profits?
Well, there's a spread. The cost of production, that's another important thing about Iraqi oil, is cost of production is very low. There's no need for oil platforms or other things like that. Because there's good pressure in the fields and they're relatively close to the surface, they can bring the oil up at a production cost of about $1 a barrel. With world market prices way over $50, that means that the spread between cost of production and cost of sale or the value of that oil is at least $50. And if you look at the Majnun field and say in round numbers it's got 20 billion barrels in there, and if you could make a $50 profit on each one, that's $1 trillion of profit locked up in one field alone.
What makes you believe that, in fact, these production sharing agreements are now being talked about and perhaps even entered into by Iraqi officials, particularly when they haven't elected their government yet?
Well, it's been pretty clear ever since the beginning. There's been there were discussions in the U.S. Department of State and in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in the U.K. Proposing this as a means for reorganizing Iraq's oil, which is of course now a national oil company. The U.S. Named two oil company officials as the main advisors to the Iraqi government, and the person who's the Iraq's oil minister today, Ibrahim Bahar al-Alum, was actually a participant and a member in the U.S. State Department's oil and energy group in the period leading up to the war. So I think we really have an arrangement which is perfect for the companies, and it's pretty much bound to get them what they want. But furthermore, it's pretty well known in circles in Baghdad and in the industry, too. I've never heard anyone in the industry deny that this isn't going to happen. So it's pretty much clear that this deal is going forward.
James Paul, director of the Global Policy Forum and co-publisher of Crude Designs, the Ripoff of Iraq's Oil Wealth. Patrick Clausen is director of research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, previously senior economist at the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the National Defense University. He's written or edited 14 books about the Middle East. Mr. Clausen, welcome to you.
Glad to be with you.
Do you buy this scenario just laid out by James Paul?
Well, it would be wonderful news for Iraqis if, in fact, there were going to be these production sharing agreements shortly, because Iraqis badly need to have more oil produced, and the country badly needs the resources that international oil companies would bring to help develop the country's natural resources. That's the reason that Saddam Hussein's government, both in 1990 and in 2002, published plans which called for international oil companies to play the key role in the further expansion of Iraq's oil industry. And that's why there's such a broad consensus in Iraq, including among former Baathists, that international oil companies have to be integral to the development of Iraq's oil industry. Iraq has tremendous oil potential and cannot now produce oil at the rate that it should in order to produce the financial resources the country so badly needs for its economic development. So it would be wonderful if, in fact, this were happening. Unfortunately, because of the security situation, it's probably not. And furthermore, it's very likely that because of the difficult security environment, that in order to attract international oil companies, that they'll have to be offered quite an inducement to get them to come into the country.
Well, as James Paul outlined it, if you could make $1 trillion, as he says Exxon could, if it got the kind of arrangement that he just described, wouldn't that be incentive enough?
Well, that's assuming that, in fact, the security situation would allow Exxon to be able to develop this field and to produce from this field. In fact, there's been extraordinary difficulties, and even the pre-war level of production has not been able to be sustained because of continuing attacks. And if I were an Exxon shareholder, I would be outraged if the company were investing in Iraq at the moment, because the security situation is so uncertain that I would think that the costs would be extraordinarily high and the grave risk that production would be disrupted. And indeed, that's why no international large international oil company is in Iraq. The Iraqis have had to turn to some quite small companies, and indeed the only ones who've been successful at getting those in are the Kurds up in the north, where the situation is much more settled than in the southern oil fields.
Would you concede, given the presence of Mr. Al-Alum, who was just described by James Paul as the current oil minister, Ahmed Chalabi also apparently has involved in this, and there are oil officials that are part of the American presence in Iraq, would you concede that at least they're probably talking about this, if you think it would be such good news for the Iraqis?
Given that Saddam Hussein talked about it, given that for 15 years Saddam Hussein talked about how this is something that he wanted to see happen, is greater involvement of international oil companies, given that this is a matter in which there's been consensus, and everybody from Baathists to World Bank officials, given that the World Bank has strongly recommended this, yes, I would just hope that they're talking about it. If they're not, they're professionally incompetent.
Patrick Clausen, again, with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I want to get a third voice into this conversation. Jamal Qureshi is lead analyst in the Oil Markets Group at PFC Energy. That's a consultancy in Washington. Clients include oil companies and government agencies as well. Mr. Qureshi, welcome to you.
Thank you.
How likely do you think it is that these deals are underway?
Well, I don't think anything is underway right now. Companies have certainly been talking with the oil ministry and officials within Iraq, but nothing is underway at this point on any significant scale. As Mr. Clausen mentioned, yes, there have been some small deals up in the north in the Kurdish regions, but right now everything is actually more hostage both to the security situation but also the political dynamics that are going on right now. You have a situation where you do not have any definition of who is really going to be in control on a governmental level of oil resources within Iraq. Is it going to be the central government, the regional governments, some shared arrangement? And that is an issue that has to be sorted out first before you even know who you can make a deal with.
So you don't think, then, as some have said, that particularly if the Shiite coalition is the most successful as a result of yesterday's voting, that the same people basically who have been running the country, the elite so-called, are going to necessarily be running it again?
Well, if you get the similar coalition back into force, you're going to set a few things in motion. First of all, you're going to get the decentralization process that's begun, which is some people say leading to an anarchic breakup of the country. That's going to accelerate, and that's going to make it very difficult to define exactly where the lines of control over oil resources are. So that's going to be one significant problem. But the other thing is that there's also an intense need for revenues in the here and now, both for central government needs but also for political patronage. This is the only source of revenue in the country. People are grabbing for their piece of power and the revenues that go along with it. So there's going to ironically also be a sense of a desire to get something moving quickly, even though you're making it tougher to define who the deal has to be made with.
If the deals, the so-called production sharing agreements, were in fact made, would you agree with Patrick Claussen that it would be wonderful for Iraqis, or would you agree with Dr. Paul that it would be a ripoff?
I'm going to have to say not quite either one. It's going to very much, again, depend on the distribution of power and revenues. That's very much an issue of how power is going to be shared within the new power arrangements and the political deals that are cut. You know, the Constitution as it is now that was just passed is very, very vague about how this is going to be managed. It was a deliberate fudge to try and specifically avoid these issues and push it off into the future. Well, now, is presuming you get greater representation from the west of Iraq and many of the Sunni regions, you're going to have a situation where people are going to want to revise that, and you're going to have fights over that. So even if you can get the deals going, then you've got to decide where the money's going to flow and how, and only then will you know if it's a good deal or not.
Jamal Qureshi, again, lead analyst at the Oil Markets Group at PFC Energy. Back to our first guest, to Dr. James Paul at the Global Policy Forum. A lot of issues have been raised here. First, let's consider security. Both of our guests have said that nothing's going to happen until there is security. No self-respecting oil company would invest any money there. Do you agree with that?
Well, basically, no, because while they're certainly correct in saying that no one is going to be making physical investments on the ground, those companies are certainly going to want to get a hold of this oil and lock it up for their own reserves. After all, these PSAs are lasting for a very long time. The companies have a very long time horizon. They want to get a hold of this oil that they can control for 25, 30, and 40 years ahead. And with oil reserves of this magnitude, any company that doesn't get a hold of this oil is going to be in trouble in the world industry in the future.
Well, the Iraqis you mentioned are pretty savvy characters, it would appear to me. Why would they enter into deals like this?
Well, there's undoubtedly some personal interest that they might have in doing these deals. Some of these people have been working very closely with the U.S. government, so it's a little hard to speculate. But the fact is that there are Iraqis who are very opposed to this. And to give you one example, the Iraq Oil Workers Union, which involves most of the oil workers in the southern oil fields, the country's biggest, is very much opposed to this, and they feel that Iraq can manage its own oil very well, and that if it does these deals, Patrick Claussen was arguing that it needs the money from the companies, but they don't need the money. They can go and use sovereign debt, and the Iraqi government can do its own oil work. Thank you very much.
All right. We are going to continue this conversation in just a moment after we take a very brief break with James Paul, Jamal Qureshi, and Patrick Claussen, talking today, of course, about Iraqi oil. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, again, has the president authorized illegal spying? Is the Pentagon monitoring legal peace protests? We'll talk about the current flap in Washington about spying. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about Iraq's massive oil reserves and whether or not oil companies are in the process of signing production sharing agreements with some officials in Iraq who might or might not be part of the future government of that country. Our first guest, Dr. James Paul of the Global Policy Forum, says he thinks that massive profits could be extracted from there by oil companies who can tie up the country's reserves for a long time to come, deprive Iraqis of the benefit of that resource. James Paul, back to you. What about the issue raised about the uncertainty politically now that the people you mentioned really will find their way into the new government? And isn't there a lot of uncertainty about that?
Well, there is uncertainty, but what's interesting to notice is how continuous some of these characters have been in charge of oil have been in the various political formations since the first Iraqi government was set up. So I expect that people like Ahmed Shalabi and Ibrahim Bahar al-Alum will will reinvent themselves in the new government, and we'll see them in very influential positions also. This is because, after all, this is a country under occupation, and the U.S. Embassy has a tremendous, and the U.S. military presence has a tremendous influence over what goes on in Iraq. And we shouldn't forget that the U.S. ambassador was himself a major advisor in the oil industry to UNICAL, which has now just become part of Chevron Texaco.
James Paul with the Global Policy Forum. Back to one of our chief skeptics here, Patrick Claussen of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Why do you say, contrary to what the oil workers' union in the southern part of Iraq apparently claims, that the Iraqis can't do this on their own? You pointed out yourself that they haven't been able, that the occupational authorities haven't been able to get the industry back into production to the extent that it was before the invasion.
Well, for the same reason why the authorities in every Persian Gulf country except Saudi Arabia have turned to international oil companies, whether it's Iran, which is not exactly a friend of the West, or the United Arab Emirates, or Kuwait, or Oman. These countries are Qatar. These countries are all turning to international oil companies to help provide the expertise and the organizational effort. Iraq has a history going back 70 years of claiming that it could do things on its own and taking proud nationalist stance of the oil industry and suffering for it. And it is to Saddam Hussein's credit that he in 1990, came out with a plan saying international oil companies will have to be involved in helping to develop the country's oil fields. Saddam's production of oil under sanctions damaged the oil fields very badly, and Iraq needs a lot of expertise, and its engineers have been cut off from the world for oil industry for a long time. They're behind in their techniques. The international oil companies would bring a lot to the table and could help expand output much more rapidly than if the Iraqis relied on just their own resources.
Jamal Qureshi, back to you with the oil markets group at PFC Energy. Your clients include both government agencies and oil companies. What's the history when countries have nationalized their oil resources and then made arrangements with oil companies, including production sharing agreements? What's the history of the countries themselves getting what all would agree is their fair share?
Well, we did come from an era, obviously, in the early days where those companies ran the show and then were nationalized. And as there's been a slow turn back to bring in capital and expertise from these companies, there's been a very mixed record. In a place like Iran, for example, because the Iranians have bargained very, very tough, they haven't gotten quite as much as what they would have wanted. On the other hand, you could look to a place like Venezuela, where despite the problems that have occurred since the strike in late 2002, the Venezuelans have tightened up their terms, and companies are staying on board because they know it's a place, they can deal with it as long as they're willing to play ball with the regime there.
So a production sharing agreement isn't necessarily then a ripoff?
No, it's very much in the details and in the terms involved. This is very much a standard sort of contract, but it can vary greatly in how it's implemented.
James Paul, back to you with the Global Policy Forum. It's your study that we're talking about here, the one that you co-published, Crude Designs, the Ripoff of Iraq's Oil Wealth. A lot of Iraqis believe that the United States is in Iraq for the oil, and a lot of Americans believe that as well. Do you?
I think it certainly looks that way. This report, of course, doesn't specifically speak to that. I think if we look at the whole history of the modern Middle East and we look at various interventions, we go back to the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953 and various other
Mossadegh
events.
In Iran.
That was in Iran, that's right. We see that both at a clandestine level and military level, the U.S. and Britain in particular have been there for the oil. In fact, I've read some cables between President Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill during World War II, and you would think they've been mainly considering the war, but they were already in the midst of the fighting talking about who was going to get what in the Middle East oil deals in the post-war period.
Back to Patrick Clausen with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Given the state of the world oil supply at this point, compared to demand and all the issues that have been raised about the peaking of oil and so on, what do you think about America's principal motivation in going into Iraq? Do you think it's oil?
Well, the United States has been quite prepared to have unilateral sanctions which prevent U.S. oil companies from taking advantage of the tremendously profitable opportunities in countries like Libya and Iran for over a 10-year period. So the United States has locked American oil companies out of some of the most lucrative investment opportunities in the world because the U.S. put first and foremost its geostrategic interests, its interests in containing the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in particular, and also with Libya stopping terrorism and with Iran as well. Now, given this long history, and of course the United States locked itself out of the Iraqi oil market for many years when Saddam Hussein was trying to invite American oil companies to invest in their country. So if in fact American foreign policy was being shaped by the interests of oil companies, we would have had an extremely different policy towards Iraq, towards Iran, and towards Libya for many years when those governments wanted our oil companies to invest, and we said no, 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 no. It wasn't necessary to invade Iraq in order to be able to invest there. It was Saddam who had been asking American oil companies to invest in Iraq for years, and the U.S. government had been saying no.
Have circumstances changed because of the argument about peak oil, the one we don't have to have time to go into on this program, but it's certainly in the background of the conversation?
In a word, no. I think that it's regarded by most of the people in this administration responsible for setting foreign policy as about as accurate science as creationism is. The peak oil theory is frequently laughed at in meetings that I attend.
Okay, back to Jamal Qureshi again at the PFC Energy with oil companies and government agencies as their clients. Do you think there's been a change as these warnings have been coming out? Again, I'm certainly not in a position to judge the science. Maybe you are. Mr. Clausen says it's no good, indicating that we're at the point of not being able to meet demand with new supplies.
Well, I think you touched on a few interesting points, and really, what I think it comes back to is the understanding of oil and the geostrategic place of oil and the role of oil markets in Washington is incredibly poor. The war, as in the case of sanctions in many cases, were primarily not about oil. They were about an ideology. And on top of that, then, came this enticing notion that many of the neoconservatives who pushed for the war had, that somehow Iraq could replace Saudi Arabia as the key central banker of oil in the world and become an American ally in that role, and also the notion that Iraq could pay for its own reconstruction that Paul Wolfowitz noted so very clearly. Both of those notions were just completely false and showed a terrible understanding of what was going on. So in Washington, yeah, perhaps this is a notion that's come up. It wasn't one of the driving factors. But what I would say is if folks in Washington are talking about the geostrategic role of oil in various oil-producing nations, generally speaking, they don't have a very good idea what they're talking about.
Jamal Qureshi at PFC Energy. Back to James Paul. Dr. Paul, Executive Director of the Global Policy Forum. Last question to you. At what point do you think we will be able to see who's right, you or our other guests on this program?
Well, it very much depends on the unfolding of politics in the country, and also really whether these deals are done and kept secret. But I think that it's going to be very, very difficult for them to remain secret. There's a lot of Iraqis who care a lot about this question. There's certainly going to be whistleblowers somewhere, and we're going to start to find out what's happening. As it was already mentioned, there's already been some small deals that have been done in the Kurdish area, and it was very interesting that the Gulbenkian interests that were involved in the original company that came in 1927 is involved in that new company and those new deals that are being done. So I would say probably in the next year or two, it'll be very clear what's happening.
Jamal Qureshi, if you would, we just have a couple of minutes left. Elaborate a bit on your point that the people in Washington don't know their geopolitics. Much has been said about the vice president, his connection to the oil companies and so on. Who exactly are you talking about, and which policies do you think have been misstructured, if that's the right word, as a result?
Well, I think, again, the basic notion that came up among many of these folks that Iraq could pay for its own reconstruction, for example, that was a misunderstanding of revenue needs as well as what Iraq could do on the oil production side, and also this notion that Saudi Arabia could somehow be displaced as the central banker of the oil markets. It would simply take far too long, and the markets are too dynamic, and we are very potentially heading to a non-OPEC peak in oil supplies. So you take all these things together, and you take a man in the form of, for example, Dick Cheney, who came from the oil service industry, but not from an oil market perspective, and he really did not have a proper grasp of that notion.
Jamal Qureshi with the Oil Markets Group at PFC Energy. Patrick Lawson with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. What about those ideas that Iraq could somehow replace Saudi Arabia, that it could pay for the cost of its own reconstruction? Were those ill-conceived? Is it still possible that those things might happen?
Well, the IMF report on Iraq's economy that was released shortly a few months ago showed that last year, in fact, Iraqis paid 94% of the cost of investment inside Iraq. And furthermore, the IMF's forecast is that over the next 5 years, that will continue to be the case, that Iraq will continue to provide 94% of the resources for investment inside Iraq. Iraq has got lots of money to pay for its own reconstruction. It doesn't have the funds to pay, of course, for the American military presence in Iraq. That's going to have to be paid for by the United States, but that is something which was universally acknowledged before the war by all U.S. government officials who addressed the question. So the simple fact is that Iraq is paying for its own reconstruction.
James Paul, we do have time for another question for you, and let me put it rather starkly. One of the executives of ConocoPhillips Oil, our former executive, has been quoted in the context of your report as saying this is paranoia on steroids. Is there a failure to understand the oil business in Washington? Is that important?
I think that's extremely unlikely. This is, remember, ExxonMobil is the biggest company in the world and the biggest company in the United States by many measures. These oil companies themselves and their industry groups have a tremendous number of lobbyists. They have people who are very friendly to them inside the State Department and inside the military and inside the executive branch. I think these arguments are extremely silly. When I expect that there's constant traffic by telephone between the people at the highest levels of the U.S. government and these companies, and there's no way that a war went on there without the companies giving it their green light.
All right. A fascinating subject. We've learned a lot about it today. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Dr. James Paul, Executive Director, Global Policy Forum, the paper Crude Designs, the Ripoff of Iraq's Oil Wealth. Jamal Qureshi with the Oil Markets Group at PFC Energy. Clients include oil companies, government agencies, and Patrick Clausen, Director for Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks once again for all of you for being with us today. Republicans in the Senate are calling for hearings into reports that President Bush secretly authorized domestic spying. As we heard earlier, that's partly why the Patriot Act was not renewed today by the Senate. The Pentagon's investigating another report that it has been monitoring legal peace protests. More on all that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Wyman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Last night, the New York Times reported that President Bush authorized the super-secret National Security Agency to eavesdrop on people inside the United States without court-approved warrants. Today, the Washington Post quotes a civil liberties activist as saying it's the first time a president has authorized the government to violate a specific criminal prohibition. James Banford is author of two books on the NSA, Body of Secrets and The Puzzle Palace. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Warren.
Is this, do you think, the first time that a president has authorized such a thing? Did he, by doing so, violate the law?
Well, it did happen before. It happened in the 1960s and 70s. Richard Nixon during the late 60s and early 70s authorized the NSA to do very similar illegal domestic surveillance. And that was the entire reason that the Congress created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act as a countermeasure to prevent the president from unilaterally making these decisions, created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978 and provided a procedure where if somebody at the NSA wants to eavesdrop on a U.S. person in the United States, it goes through this secret court known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and gets a warrant to do it. And apparently in these cases, it hasn't been done.
How many cases are being reported on by the New York Times, and who's involved?
Well, the New York Times mentioned between several hundred and several thousand possible calls. They mentioned the targets were people who allegedly had some connections with terrorism or whatever. But you know what's interesting about that is that's exactly what the court was set up for. If the government has some targets that they think may be involved in terrorism or have some knowledge of terrorism, that's the whole idea. They go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and the court has never turned the government down. I think in 30 years, I think there was one time that they turned the government down. But it's a very easy procedure to get a warrant, and why they didn't do it is a very interesting question.
Raised a lot of hackles in the Congress, including some of those on the necks of Republicans. You said that the New York Times is reporting hundreds, perhaps thousands, of people involved. International phone calls and emails, is that the extent of it? Is that pretty much what's been looked at?
That's what they were saying was focused on. But in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, it didn't make any difference. Those, even if it was international calls, they should still get a warrant as long as it's a what they call a U.S. person in the United States that's involved in the call, whether they're calling domestically or whether they're calling or being called internationally. The law still applies, and they're supposed to go through the Foreign Intelligence Court, get a warrant before they begin that eavesdropping. Otherwise, you know, if there is no procedure to go through the court, the executive branch can decide to eavesdrop on anybody, anytime, at any place.
I should say that the White House today will neither confirm nor deny these reports that President Bush has done, as you said, Richard Nixon did in the 60s and 70s, authorize this kind of surveillance. In the meantime, the Foreign Intelligence Act passed, and the Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Court Intelligence Surveillance Court, set up to try to avoid exactly that procedure. Again, James Banford, Body of Secrets and the Puzzle Palace, both about the National Security Agency. On Wednesday, the Pentagon promised an investigation after reports that the military has been gathering information on legal peace protesters and others who apparently pose no threat to U.S. security. Bill Arkin revealed some 1,500 incidents on his blog Early Warning on thewashingtonpost.com and on NBC News. Bill Arkin, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Tell us a bit about this.
Well, we've known for some time that the Pentagon has increasingly encroached upon civilian life inside the United States, and that the military has been given greater and greater responsibilities for counterterrorism under the guise or the name of force protection, which is the defense of military installations, property and persons and interests. The military has been increasingly monitoring and collecting information about everything, if you will, that might be an indicator of terrorist activity. And ironically, Warren, there's a very strong link to the whole NSA debate that we were talking about earlier, and that is that this is part of a post-9/11 paradigm, connect the dots. Collect lots and lots and lots of information, and through that collection and analysis, perhaps detect instances of where there are clandestine or covert connections between lawful activity and terrorist organizations. And I think that's at the root of both Pentagon spying as well as this increased authority for the NSA.
You were formerly involved in Army intelligence yourself. Is this a standard procedure? Is it effective? Is it a way of protecting people?
Well, those are two separate questions. Is it standard procedure and is it effective? Standard procedure is you give the military a mission and they march forth smartly. And so if you tell the military that its responsibility is force protection in the United States and you define that mission so broadly as to include anything that constitutes Department of Defense interests, what is it that you expect that they're going to do except go out there and look for the enemy? So that's what the military does, and I think pending given other directions and other mission orders, no one should be surprised that this is how they have responded. The effectiveness question, of course, is an interesting one. It seems to me that every moment that the military spends looking at anti-war groups or at anti-recruiting groups or collecting meticulous information about trivial incidents that have nothing to do with terrorism is a moment that they're not focusing on the actual terrorists and they're not focusing on the actual threats. And I think that even if someone is not critical of the military or not particularly concerned about American civil liberties, I would think that they would be concerned that the government is wasting its time doing this when it could be doing something that's much more important.
William Arkin, military affairs analyst for NBC and the Washington Post Online columnist. Back to James Banford, author of Body of Secrets and the Puzzle Palace about the National Security Agency. Do you agree that the NSA might be involved in the revelations we've heard about today from the New York Times and the Washington Post in things that are trivial, that are beside the point?
Well, it's hard to say since there was no indication of exactly what was the subject of the conversations or exactly who were the targets they were looking at. But the key question is, when you have an agency that is as powerful as NSA, and again, NSA is the largest and most secret intelligence agency in the world. It's three times the size of the CIA, and it's given an enormous amount of secrecy by the U.S. government. And in addition to that, it has the capability of eavesdropping on virtually anybody, anywhere, at any time. The entire function of the agency is eavesdropping on people. And the whole reason of creating the FISA court was to keep that agency outside the United States so that we don't turn into an Orwellian 1984-style country. And the only thing separating, really, the NSA from creating that type of an atmosphere within the United States is this law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Law. And if the administration decides to bypass that law or ignore the law, then, Senator Frank Church, who looked into the NSA once said, nobody will have any place to hide. And I think that's the big danger.
What's the significance of the President of the United States being the one who secretly signs an order allowing the NSA to perform in the way that the papers have described it? I should say, incidentally, that the New York Times withheld their report for a year, they said in their story today, because the government asked them to, based on the thought that there would be a security breach if they did. And they said they withheld some elements of what they knew as well. Back to you, James Bamford. What do you think is going on there? And are they trying to protect the White House? Or what about the security issues involved?
Well, it's hard to say. It's very somewhat confusing. I mean, I have to follow that law, and the president has to follow that law. It's a law that governs the conduct of U.S. officials in the United States. And I don't know what kind of an order he could sign that bypasses that law. I mean, he could sign an executive order, but that doesn't bypass a federal statute. So I'm not sure what they're talking about in terms of what sort of secret document the president can sign that could avoid the law. But it was very interesting reading the article where the Chief Justice of the FISA Court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, was herself alarmed at the White House doing this, or at least the NSA doing this behind their back, because she commented at one point, I think, that when they came, the NSA was coming and asking for permission to get an eavesdropping warrant, some of the evidence they were presenting had come from eavesdropping operations that the court had never approved. And I think that caused her to be outraged at the fact that the government was going around behind the court to get these secret eavesdropping warrants from the court.
And as you pointed out, the court has never been known to turn down a request for this kind of search when it was asked to do so.
Not only that, if the court does, I think in over 30 years, it's only turned it down once. And even in that case, when the court turns it down, there is another court that was created. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Appeals Court, that in its entire history has only heard one case. So if the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court turns down the government can appeal it to the Foreign Intelligence Appeals Court, and if they turn it down, they could appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court for an immediate in-camera session.
Okay.
So the odds of the government not getting a warrant are virtually impossible.
Bill Arkin, time for a yes or no answer to this question. Is the military affected by that act, the Foreign Intelligence Act?
Yes, well, the National Security Agency warrant is a part of the Department of Defense, and so, yes, it applies across the board.
Thank you both. Bill Arkin, again, with NBC, Washington Post Online, and James Banford, author of Body of Secrets and The Puzzle Palace, about the National Security Agency. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, Sharon Rembau, managing producer Karen Ransiner, thanks to the John Coltrane family, and our technical director, Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live. Live is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.